call a specific format for this morning and part of this afternoon is that I'm going to begin with a little bit of report on the scientific discoveries of the past few weeks that are adding to the weight of evidence for the existence of the God of the Bible and the reliability of the Bible. And I've got all these file folders filled with new articles from the literature. And the way I'm going to work this is I'm going to keep giving reports as quickly as I can on each of these discoveries until I begin to see a few people coming up to the microphones, in which case I'll stop talking and you get to talk and we get to deal with the questions and comments that you might have. And if there's a lull in the proceedings at the microphones, I'll go back and pick up another research paper and we'll take you through that. So that's kind of how we're going to run this morning. We do have one rule at the microphone. You're welcome to ask as many questions as you would like, but we're going to confine you to one question at a time at the microphone. So if you've got eight questions, you'll have to come to the microphone eight times. Okay, so that gives everybody a chance to participate, and it's also a way to help deal with my failing memory. I don't have to try to remember all eight of your questions. I've mentioned at previous forums like this that our team at Reasons to Believe is counting about a scientific discovery per day that adds to the weight of evidence for the God of the Bible and the reliability of the Bible. But it was just 2 weeks ago that Dr. Fuzz Rana joined our staff. He's a biophysicist and a biochemist combined. And he's our first scientist to join our staff full-time besides myself. And because he's not loaded down with the kinds of responsibilities I am, he's got more time to read the literature than I do. And he came to me the other day and says, "Hey, Hugh, just in my own discipline, I think we can make it two per day, two scientific discoveries per day." So, and I've been feeding him some stuff, too, from the stuff I've been reading. And I'm going to start off with one of those. So this is not in my area of expertise. It's in the area of Dr. Fuzz Rana's. And I think at one of these skeptics forums, we're going to arrange to have Fuzz Rana to join me here, and you can hear from him. But this paper just got published. Crystal structure of the ATP binding subunit of an ABC transporter. I mean, you know, when I tell you that astronomy is simple and that biology is complex, maybe the title of this paper will help you recognize that. But this is kind of a breakthrough in that this is a map of one of these complex biological molecules that's done at greater resolution than it's ever been done before. You know, like in astronomy, for example, there's been many new discoveries of God that have come about through new technology and new telescopes. We heard about this Fuse telescope that's going up, and I'm anticipating some discoveries from that instrument. But, for example, the Hubble Space Telescope and the Keck telescope have been responsible for some of the most significant evidences for the God of the Bible. Well, likewise, in biochemistry, there's been some new instruments. They're called scanning X-ray imaging units. And, you know, I've talked a little bit in the past year about instruments that were able to resolve these molecules down to about 2.5 angstroms. You say, well, what's an angstrom? It's something an astronomer invented to tell you what wavelength a particular beam of light is radiating at. And basically, it's a nanometer, so it's a very tiny unit of measure. But in this paper, there is the first map of a molecule made at a resolution of 1.5 angstroms. And at 1.5 angstroms, you can almost see the individual atoms. You can see the bigger atoms, but even the little atoms become visible with that kind of resolution. And as I've mentioned before, when you're down at, say, a 2 angstroms resolution, you're able to see design in these molecules that have been hidden from the biochemists up until now. And this is a prime example that biochemists for decades have wanted to look into a class of engines. They knew that these molecules were engines, but they couldn't exactly see what the engine was like. And with resolution at 1.5 angstroms, they're able to do that. In fact, this is a map of the most common engine we find within the cell. You'll say, well, what is the engine? I'll give you the technical name first, then I'll break it down into layman's language. It's called the nucleotide binding domain, and they biochemists love these acronyms. They simply call it an NBD, and they assume everybody knows what an NBD is. So, but what this NBD is, it's a transporter protein. So it's a protein that transports other molecules that are important to the cell. Let me give you a better layman's description. It's a traffic regulator. So it's a molecule that regulates the traffic flow of other molecules into and out of the cell. Better yet, I can say it's a traffic cop. So it's a traffic policeman. You know what traffic policemen do? They kind of wave traffic in different directions. And they're like the police at the gates of a city. And so these NBD molecules operate at the membrane of the cell, and they control what comes into the cell and what leaves the cell and at what rate. So it's kind of like going down to L.A. airport, and you're coming in from a foreign country, and you go through customs and immigration. So it's that kind of a situation. They regulate who gets in and what they can bring in. Now, this particular X-ray scanner was able to map one of these molecules with such great detail they could actually see the engine components. And they were able to see, for example, particular units that would emulate the equivalent of a motor. Now, motors have been imaged before with this X-ray technology. I discussed, I think, two forums ago how they were able to map the equivalent of a three-stroke engine. And so it would be like one of these little engines in a Geo Metro car. It's a three-piston engine. They could see the pistons. They could see the crankshaft. So, and they saw something that they were able to calculate was the smallest three-stroke engine possible under the laws of physics. And these things are common throughout the cells. And this is a little bit different kind of engine, but you have this little motor that runs, and the motor has been seen before. So this is a motor that kind of turns things around like this. So you've got the motor, but they also found a molecular pulley. So there's this pulley that's hooked to the motor. And then there's the equivalent of a drive belt. So there's these little molecules that are hooked to the pulley, and they go up to another pulley, okay? So they're able to transfer their driving energy to another location within the cell. So you've got motors, belts, pulleys, and these pulleys are connected to ratchets and gates. And so you see these molecular ratchets. They're like little gears, and they run around, and they have these spokes coming out of the gear. And what the spokes do is they're able to regulate the flow of other molecules into or out of the cell. In fact, the ratchets they discovered with this instrument acts like a pump. And so when the pulley is hooked up to a ratchet with big thick teeth, then these ratchets working against one another are able to pump molecules from outside the cell into the cell, and then are able to pump the garbage that's inside the cell that needs to be expelled to the outside. And so you've got these little pumps working at the membranes of the cell. A different kind of molecule, slightly different kind of molecule, has the same components, motors and pulleys and drive belts, but this time the drive belt is hooked up to what we would call a gate. And it's a gate that's kind of a lot like what you would see in a lock. And what I mean by a lock is those things that ships go through, like in the Panama Canal. The ship goes into a lock and a gate closes at the back and a gate closes at the front. They fill it up with water. The boat goes up. When it's up to a particular level, one of the gates opens and it moves into another lock and the process repeats itself. And that way a ship can go up and down through the isthmus of Panama. Well, likewise, they're finding with this X-ray scanning instrument one of these molecules has a gate that's every bit as sophisticated as what you would see in the locks of the Isthmus of Panama, namely that these molecular walls will slam shut and nothing gets in or out. The membranes protect it. And then when they see something outside that they want to get in, the gate opens up, and then that particular molecule is allowed to come in or to go out. And then the gate shuts again. And these molecules, these proteins, have little tiny molecular detectors. And it's kind of like the police going to you at the customs saying, let me see your passport. Well, likewise, this protein has a little tiny molecule attached to it that is able to detect friend from foe and say, yeah, this is one we want in, this is one we don't want in, and that will trigger the gate to open or the gate to close. And then finally, they have found some of these NBDs that are regulators, which means that the gate might open up a little bit and allow so many of these molecules to flow in at a certain rate. Kind of like what you might have, it's kind of like what you have in your kitchen sink. You have a little tap there, and you can open up the tap partway, and you get a slow flow of water rather than a big gush of water. Well, likewise, there's some of these NVDs at the membrane that let the molecules that are waiting outside that they want to get in to flow in at a particular rate, not too fast. So if they come in too fast, then the proteins inside the molecule aren't going to be able to, and then these proteins would be the factories. They won't be able to handle the raw materials coming in. And so these regulators at the cell will make sure that the factories inside the cell get not too many of the incoming molecules or not too few of those incoming molecules. And again, you might say, well, how does this molecule know what's the right amount? Again, it's got these little signal and tiny proteins attached to them that are able to detect what is the correct amount that should flow in. Now, the whole design argument in all of this is that if you're coming at this from, say, a naturalist perspective or an evolutionist perspective, you're drawing the conclusion that these molecules somehow randomly came together by chance to perform these functions. Well, this is somewhat equivalent to looking inside your car, which has this nice engine turning around, your four-piston engine or whatever, and then you see inside your car engine all these pulleys and belts that are doing different things within the engine. And so you might be taking your Toyota engine, for example, looking at it and saying, you know, that marvelous engine I see there that makes my car run so well and all the little components I got attached to that motor, all that happened just by chance. Toyota didn't build that motor. What happened was there was a big, huge hurricane that went through one of those Minnesota iron ore belts and just happened to dig out the iron ore, process it such a way, and randomly assemble it such that I got this wonderful motor doing all these things. I mean, what we really see in this, in fact, what's wonderful about this paper was published in Nature, I got black and white, but the original has it all in color. This molecule is so complex, they weren't able to show the reader its functionality in just one color. They got a dozen different colors. And in fact, when you read the figures, what it tells you is what all the color codes mean, so they can help you to distinguish one molecular function from another. And as I went through this, I said, this is even more complicated than the Toyota motor I'm using as an analogy. And so just like you would think somebody was crazy to think that a Toyota motor just happened to put itself together, even over billions of years, likewise, I think we would say it's not really rational to conclude that this molecule, with all of its functionality, could have just happened on its own without some intelligent design, some divine intervention on a part of the creator of the universe that structured it in such a way. And as you move from simple sciences like astronomy to complex sciences, we see the evidence for design actually become stronger. The problem is, in the complex sciences like biochemistry, we've lacked the instrumentation and we've lacked the personnel to dig into it to see the design that's been there. For so many decades, it's been hidden. Now, for the first time, it's being revealed. But I'm also impressed just how few people are doing these imaging experiments. It's not like astrophysics where we've got hundreds of astronomers making measurements on the beginning of the universe and therefore coming up with all kinds of design evidences. In this case, we have just a few workers. And they're using these brand new instruments that are very expensive, and we're just beginning to uncover design. And so, for example, in your discussions, when people make comments, well, there is no design in biology. The truth of the matter is we simply haven't been able to see that design until just the past few months. So that's one. And, if you give me time, I got another six articles in here on molecular design. And Fuzz Rana says he's got me beat. He's already collected, just these past 2 weeks, 300 research papers documenting molecular design. He's eager to write about all of them in our first issue of Facts for Faith, our new news magazine. But I've told Fuzz, it's only 40 pages long. We're going to make you select the ones that you're going to be able to do. Okay, we got a gal at the mic here. We'll take her question, and then we'll get into some of the other disciplines of science. As things pause. Yes.
Hi, Dr. Ross. Can you define the word Pelagianism and explain how it relates or doesn't relate to our beliefs here at SNCC?
Can I define Pelagianism? I have a hard time pronouncing it. It's Pelagianism. My wife says I have a hard time in front of this mic because I'm one of those individuals that learned to read before I learned to speak. So I'm still quite visual in this. But in fact, I might ask you if you could come back to the mic, okay? I'm going to put you on the spot. No. The problem is Pelagianism is a kind of an aberrant belief within the Christian community that arose within the first century A.D., but even in the first century A.D., there are many different forms of Pelagianism.
Okay.
And today, it's rising up again, this Pelagianism. And again, many different forms, some of those forms not the same as what we had in the first century. I was wondering...
What would be the common definition if you spoke with... I mean, what would be the most common belief then?
Well, okay.
Or if you use that word, what would most people refer to it? Yeah.
Okay. It's kind of come back.
Okay.
People have forgotten about this for hundreds of years. Well, it's coming back now.
In its origin and then how it's kind of coming back.
Okay. But I just wanted to make sure you weren't after some specific point of Pelagianism.
Yeah. No, just that would answer my question.
Okay. I'll tell you where it's coming.
Are you here?
No, you don't. I'll tell you where it's starting to come back. There's been an interesting ecumenical attempt for Protestants and Catholics to come together. In fact, about 2 years ago, there was a statement published in Christianity Today which basically said, you know, we Christians, and they meant Christians globally, are facing stresses in secular society like we never have before. And what we need to do is, as Christians of a broad stripe, is come together, unite together, to deal with the attacks from secular society, because if we don't unite, we're all going to fall. And, there were some famous Christians who appended their name to this joint statement about where we need to unite and where we can agree. But there was also a reaction to that. Several theologians within the Protestant camp said, look, this statement of unity goes too far, and we can't go along with everything that's within that statement. And there got to be a battle between Chuck Colson, who signed the first statement, and R.C. Sproul, who said, as a Reformed theologian, I can't put my name to that statement of unity, and then kind of a big fight developed within the evangelical community that has only recently been healed. I want to tell you that Chuck Colson and R.C. Sproul have come together, and they've agreed that both sides were guilty of excesses, and so they've kind of made, it's been resolved. at least in the minds of the two that started this whole thing, okay? There's still a lot of ferment going on elsewhere. And the whole point is, what is necessary for salvation? And, just to kind of put traditionally what was going on in the first century and what was going on in the Reformation, what's going on today, is it Jesus Christ and Jesus Christ alone? Is it salvation by faith alone? Is it grace alone? Or do works make some contribution? And, the Catholic position has been one of Jesus Christ, grace, salvation by faith, and the tradition of the church. So the traditions of the church were important, and then the church hierarchy itself, namely the Pope and what do you call those guys that wear the red hats, the cardinals, right? Sorry. Priests, etc. So as the church hierarchical structure, the church traditions, and faith in Jesus Christ. Another form of Pelagianism is this idea that sola scriptura, that was kind of the founding charge of the Reformation movement. All we need is scripture. All we need is the Bible. And so then the Catholics and the Eastern Orthodox were saying, no, in addition to the Bible, God has given us revelation through the church. And so it's the church plus the Bible, or it's the church plus the Bible plus the hierarchy, or it's not just by grace. Works are important too. We must perform these works. And then another subtle form of it that creeps into aspects of Protestantism is this whole business about the Eucharist. We practice communion. But the Roman Catholics have taught, at least some segments of the Roman Catholic Church, namely that you must take communion. And is this really true? Are we required as Christians to take communion in order to sustain our salvation? I've met Catholics, for example, who felt that they didn't take communion every single week, they were headed or condemned to hell. And so they were under this pressure. Now, most Catholic priests that I've talked to today are not willing to go that far. In fact, it's been amusing to me that in some Protestant denominations, there's more concern about taking communion as a necessary aspect of salvation than I find in certain elements of the Catholic Church. I say this because often we get into these issues of the Pelagianism heresy. We tend to think it's always the Roman Catholics or always the Eastern Orthodox. I'd like to suggest it's not that simple. Certain aspects of this heresy creep into the Protestant faith as well. So that's kind of why I asked the question of the young lady who came to the microphone, what component of Pelagianism are you concerned about? Because there are many different forms. In fact, there's one form that affects us at Reasons to Believe. Namely, there are those who, within the Protestant camp, say sola scriptura means that God only reveals himself through the words of the Bible. He does not reveal himself through nature. He does not reveal himself through the conscience. Or they might say he does reveal himself through our conscience and through the record of nature, but it's not a trustworthy revelation. The only trustworthy revelation would be through the words of the Bible. Now, people like R.C. Sproul, who's probably the strongest proponent of sola scriptura, says that's an abuse of sola scriptura, and certainly John Calvin would also hold that that was an abuse of sola scriptura. He's a guy that invented the term. Namely, need to understand that the Word of God includes what he's written on our hearts. The heavens declare the glory of God. His words are written on the heavens for everyone to read. And so we've been involved in Reasons to Believe in saying that you can take anti-Pelagianism so far that it itself becomes a heresy. So I'm frankly quite glad that this is being discussed at the end of the 20th century, because I would agree that these Pelagianistic tendencies have always been in the church. And it's difficult for any Christian to balance faith and works. And I think James says it best. Yes, we are saved by faith and faith alone. On the other hand, if our faith does not bear fruit in terms of good works, then we have reason to question whether that saving faith has ever taken place within the heart of that individual. As James put it, says, you've got faith? Great. Show me the proof of your faith. But the whole point in terms of the Reformation movement is the works don't come first. The faith comes first. We are saved by faith and faith alone. Ephesians 2, it's grace alone that brings us into the presence of God. It's God's work, 100% God's work, 0% my work. But what happens when I become justified of my sin? Okay, what does it tell us in Philippians 2:13? The Holy Spirit, upon that moment of salvation, fills us with the power and the desire to do God's will. And so I would be quite in line with the Word of God to say, if you claim that you've been saved by faith in Jesus Christ and faith alone, that one of the evidences of this born-again experience, this baptism of the Holy Spirit in your life, is that the Holy Spirit should be filling you with the desire to obey God and the power to obey God. And there's something liberating about that. I do not have to drum up within my own volition, my own self-will, the power to obey God. In fact, how I read Philippians 2 is this way. There is nothing within me that wants to obey God. There is nothing within me that would give me the strength to obey God. If it's not for God's Holy Spirit, I'm not going to make it at all. But yeah, one of the evidences that I've been baptized in the Holy Spirit is that I have a desire and power to obey God's will. And here's another evidence. It's almost effortless what's happening within you. If you find yourself really working hard to try to obey what God has written in His Word, that's not the Holy Spirit. That's the flesh within you trying to do what it's impossible for the flesh to do. You will feel frustrated. You will feel depressed. You'll feel defeated. And that's God's way of tapping you on the shoulder and say, hey, step out of the way, let me take over. Okay.
It's as complicated as we're finding that things are on a molecular biological level. Has anyone ever tried to figure out or calculate how many mutations it would take to go from, say, nothing to a single cell organism, or from a single cell organism to a human being, and then divide that by the number of years there's been life on the planet and how many mutations a year or however that would take to get to that point?
Okay, very good question. And the answer to that is that's just beginning. If you were to ask me that question, say, 3 or 4 years ago, I would say nothing's happening. But something is happening today. And what's going on is that biologists, biochemists, have discovered what they call molecular clocks. And this would be ways of measuring at a molecular level what would be the maximum and minimum mutation rates within that molecule. So, for example, if you can measure the mutation rate in, say, the male Y chromosome, or the mutation rate in the mitochondrial DNA that we get from our mothers. And then you could say, well, if we're claiming that orangutans and human beings are descended from a common ancestor that lived 15 million years ago, let's look at how many differences there are in the genes between an orangutan and a human being. And now that we know the natural mutation rates in the human being and the orangutan, let's see if it's reasonable to explain all the genetic differences between these two species in something as brief as 15 million years. Now, when that research is done, the answer is that the molecular clock runs too slow. It's always come out that way. But, you know, Darwinism is going to survive as a philosophy within modern society, then you would expect that the morphological changes that we see in the fossil record would be consistent with the molecular clocks. And what we see initially is that they're not. But keep in mind this has only been done for just a few species and only for pieces of the genetic material. Typically, they do this kind of research for only 1,000 nucleotides. Okay, the human genome has 6 billion nucleotide pairs. And so we have a long way to go to make this any kind of a rigorous science. Again, the more complex the science, the more difficult it is to really see the design that's going on there. But I personally think molecular clock research is going to prove a very fruitful endeavor for developing new evidences for the hand of the God of the Bible.
Thank you.
Yes.
Some evolutionists would argue that morphological isolation would be evidence for evolution, in particular with the dog species like the Chihuahua and the Great Dane. And I'm wondering how you would answer them and show them that it's not actually evolution that's taking place, but it's just change within a species.
Okay, good question. Certain evolutionists will point to things like what we've done with dogs or cows as an example that, natural selection and the mutations over a period of time can explain very significant changes. How do you respond to that kind of an argument? Well, number one, the most extreme examples we've seen are those where you get human breeding control. I mean, how do we come up with Chihuahuas and Great Danes, starting with foxes, wolves, and coyotes? And that's kind of what you begin with. You take a few wild canines and use those and begin to produce the breed that you want. You say, well, I want something really small. And so what you do is every time a couple of foxes come together, you pick the runt of the litter. And then you breed runt versus runt, and gradually the fox becomes smaller and smaller and smaller, and you wind up with a little Chihuahua. In fact, in this century, dog breeders have been successful in breeding very small poodles. And they now got what they call a teacup poodle, which is a poodle that is so tiny it can fit inside a teacup. And likewise, they've gone the other way. Say, I want a dog that's big enough that my kid can ride, okay? And so that's where the Great Dane comes from. But what we've discovered in the process is that the farther we breed away from the natural wild origin, so it should be the coyote, the fox, the dingo, the wolf, the less survivable that particular breed becomes. And we can imagine what would happen if we were to release all the teacup poodles into the wild. Now, will they survive even one generation? But we'd be rather amazed if they survive even a couple of days. Okay? I've seen that in my own family. We had this exceptional breed of a cat. The cat got outside one day, and that was the end of the cat. It became owl food. Whereas the other two cats that we now have, I have no concerns about they becoming owl food. They can fend off an owl okay, but not that little white cat we have. And they might say, well, the Great Dane wouldn't fall into that category. Yes, it does. By breeding a dog that big, what you discover is that the internal organs of a Great Dane are unstable. And it's really rare for a Great Dane to live past 9 years, and the only reason they make it 9 years is we protect them inside our homes, we give them a particular diet, and we do our best to protect their very fragile internal organs. What's going to happen if you throw all the Great Danes into the wild? They're going to eat a whole lot more than a teacup poodle, and they're not going to be able to hunt as successfully as a wolf or a coyote. And the point is, if we were to release the 400 breeds of dogs that we have bred into the wild and provide them with no human support, I think what we're going to see is that evolution worked the other way. It wouldn't be very much time before all that would be left would be those breeds of dogs that look a whole lot like wolves, foxes, coyotes, and dingoes, and the rest will disappear. And in that sense, several biologists, including many who are not Christians, not even theists, have written in the literature that natural selection, which is what breeding is all about, what you do in breeding is you select out the creatures that you want. And sometimes that happens in the natural realm through geographical or environmental stress. But the point is that natural selection is not an argument for change. It's an argument for status. And what natural selection really does is maintain a species where it is rather than forcing a species to change into a different kind of species. And where environmental stress forces change, very common with plants, less common with animals, what you really wind up with is a species that is less survivable than the original species if it weren't for the environmental stress. And let me give you an example. We have this disease called gonorrhea. And gonorrhea has now evolved almost totally where it's resistant to penicillin. But this penicillin-resistant gonorrhea is not as efficient at reproducing. It's not as efficient as metabolizing food from its hosts as the original gonorrhea bacterium was. And so, yeah, we've got this new gonorrhea species, but from a genetic standpoint, it's not as advanced as the one that replaced it. The only reason why it exists is because we put penicillin into the environment. So in that sense, we would see that trying to explain the fossil record through natural selection really is a no-win situation, unless we're talking species that are sexual, very numerous, with short generation times. Something I've written about in this book, The Genesis Question, is that we can put mathematical constraints on Darwinian evolution. And this is not my work. I borrowed it from my friends at Caltech, where there's a, I think they've had the distinction of forming the first research group of mathematical biologists. In fact, a bunch of them attend our biologist think tank, and they said, you know, the only reason Darwinism exists in biology is because biologists aren't forced to take a lot of mathematics. Bring mathematics into the situation, Darwinism immediately disappears. That was probably most forcefully demonstrated back in 1966 when there was a joint conference between evolutionary biologists and mathematicians. And at the end of that meeting, the evolutionary biologist said, we'll never have a meeting like this again. Because the mathematicians just totally demolished the Darwinian principles. And the biologists were amazed that none of the mathematicians were Darwinists. And the mathematicians were amazed that any of the biologists would even pay attention to Darwinism. But that meeting has never happened since, as successful as it was from an academic standpoint. But what I got from my friends at Caltech are the following principles. That if you want to change a species through mutations and natural selection, you better have a very large population. And the reason for that is the ratio of harmful mutations, mutations that would lead to the extinction of the species, to favorable mutations, which would lead to more than surviving, at best is 10,000 to 1. At worst, it's 10 million to 1. And so with a ratio of 10,000 to 1 harmful to beneficial, the only species that are going to survive to receive the benefit of these mutations are those that have very large populations. And what this group at Caltech calculated is that the break-even point falls somewhere around a quadrillion individuals. If the species is more than a quadrillion individuals, they get a fairly decent chance of evolving. If they have fewer than a quadrillion individuals, they're going to go extinct before any change in the species takes place. Now, this assumes that they're sexual. If they're asexual, the possibility for change just goes out the window, even if they have a very large population. And perhaps the best demonstration of that, you know whom we're all supposed to be evolved from? According to the neo-Darwinist paradigm, all of us come from these unicellular algae life forms in the oceans. But the problem there is they're not sexual, they're asexual. And yes, they exist in the quintillions. There's all kinds of that stuff out there. In fact, it probably accounts for over half of the biomass of the entire planet. So they exist in huge quantities. But the fossils we have of these unicellular algae life forms that are 3 billion years old, 2 billion years old, 1 billion years old, a half billion years old, 100 million years old, are identical to the fossils of these unicellular algae life forms that died yesterday. We don't see any change in the fossil structure over 3 billion years. And as my friends over at Caltech point out, that's because they're asexual. And if they're asexual, it's very difficult, even with mutations, to get any change going on, even in a very large population. But if they're sexual, you can get changes going on. But you'd better have more than a quadrillion individuals. You also need a generation time less than about 3 months. Now, in my book, I give you four other factors that you need to take into account, like body size, food supply, environmental constraints, the complexity of the proteins within the particular species. All of those are factors. But the two biggest ones are population size and generation time. Now, what's interesting about the mathematical models coming out of Caltech, it's consistent with our field observations. Which species do we observe evolving? And which species do we observe going extinct? We have never seen a species, an animal species, a sexual animal species evolve that has fewer than a quadrillion individuals. It's never been observed. Species that have more than a quadrillion, we've observed it many times. And the bigger the number of individuals, the more evidence we have for evolutionary change. Where do we see it most easily? Viruses. Well, viruses aren't in the quadrillions, they're in the quintillions. And there we see rather efficient Darwinian evolution going on. In fact, we see it almost on a monthly basis. You don't have to look very long to see the Darwinian evolution. And that's why we're having such difficulty conquering the common cold. You know, we come up with a defense against last year's cold viruses, but guess what? The virus has already evolved into something else. And so we're always trying to catch up with the evolution of the virus. Bacteria like the gonorrhea are also able to evolve through Darwinian principles. What are the species that have the hardest difficulty evolving? Human beings, whales, horses, camels, anything that's really big, got loads of protein in it, has low populations, a long generation time, they're not going to evolve, they're going to go extinct. And the creation model we've developed here in the Genesis question is one that the reason why we see dozens of transitional forms in the fossil record for whales and horses and bipedal primates, for example, is because they go extinct so rapidly. God happens to like those kinds of creatures, and so when they go extinct, he makes new ones. And that's why we see 20 transitional forms for the horse. God likes horses. So when they go extinct, he makes a new one. But can that Eohippus evolve into an equus under natural conditions? No way. The horse is much too big, far too few individuals, much too long a generation time, far too specialized a food supply to change. Pardon me? Okay. The Eohippus, the first horse we see in the fossil record. Repeat the question. He said, what did you say? What do you mean that God creates another one? Okay. The Eohippus, if you looked at your high school biology textbook, I'm not criticizing the college-level textbooks. They're usually much more complete and honest about what's going on. But almost every high school textbook shows you this proof of Darwinian evolution. This little horse-like creature they call the Eohippus, with a whole bunch of species in between over a timeline leading up to the modern horse. The truth is that we see fossil evidence for those 20 different species, but we don't see any evidence in the fossil record of one of those 20 species changing gradually into the other species. What we see is the Eohippus exists unchanged for a period of time, then disappears from the fossil record. Then you wait a little bit, and suddenly you get a new species appearing in the fossil record, but it doesn't change. It just kind of stays there. Then it disappears. Then you get another one, and so on until you fill out all 20 species of the horse between Eohippus and the equus. What I've argued in my book is that evidence for divine intervention. It's not evidence for natural process evolution. Each of those creatures exists unchanged, but because they're so large in terms of their body size and so few in terms of their population numbers, and at such long generation times and such specialized food supplies, and the fact that they're composed almost entirely of protein means that they're not going to last long once God creates them. As we see in the book of Genesis chapter 1, we have the laws of thermodynamics in place through all six creation days. That means when God creates a species of life, it's already on the road. In our last issue of Connections, making the point that the negative mutation rate in human beings is so extremely high that we may be disappearing faster than we thought. Also, cultural factors are working to bring about our rapid extinction. And that's the other thing. These highly advanced mammals tend to build in cultural factors that tend to speed up their extinction. Bottom line is this. When we're talking like whales and horses and bipedal primates, it's really rare for an individual species to survive more than 500,000 years. And so God creates them. After 500,000 years or 1,000,000 years, they go extinct. God likes horses. So he says, well, since these horses are gone, I'll make a new one. So he makes a new one. But they go extinct too. Then God replaces that. So in other words, what I'm talking about here in the Genesis question is that the six creation days are one of God creating hundreds of billions of species. And the more advanced ones go extinct more rapidly, so he replaces them more often than he does, say, the cockroaches. Cockroaches, because they're so small and they don't have that much protein and they exist with huge populations and relatively short generation times, the negative mutations aren't going to snuff them out for about 250,000,000 years. And so we don't see as many divine interventions for the insects as we do the large land mammals or the large sea mammals. There we see lots of interventions. But what's going on in the creation-evolution debate is that evolutionists interpret these interventions as transitional forms. You know, here's a species that's in transition between the Eohippus and the Equus. A good way to counter that is to make the point that all 20 species of the horse that we see running from Eohippus to Equus is fully functional. It's kind of like that dinosaur they found with feathers on it. The feathers were fully functional. As fully functional as flightless birds' feathers are today. You don't see half a feather. You don't see half a liver or half an eye or a liver that can't function as a liver because it's still in the process of evolving. We don't see that in a fossil record. It's always fully functional, which is kind of what you would draw if you look at automobiles. Do automobiles evolve naturally without any kind of design going on? From a Model T Ford into a 1999 Mustang or Thunderbird? I don't think so. What's one of the evidences against that? All the intervening models of cars were fully functional. Therefore, that would speak of a designer or a creator, namely a Ford Motor Company, rather than the Model T naturally evolving into a more advanced automobile. Now, another question you could raise from all that is, why would God do that? But that's really the reason I put this up. And I just mentioned, I'm not going to get into the why unless somebody wants me to, but some people do. Okay. Because what I've discovered in discussing this with professors of evolution or biology, it's not enough to tell people what's going on. They want to ask the question, well, why would God do that? Why doesn't God just make the horse the Equus and forget all his 19 that preceded it? It seems like such a waste or so inefficient for God to do all that. And what we point out in both Beyond the Cosmos and the Genesis question, we need to understand that God is creating in a universe where things change with respect to time. And so the same species that would be effective here on planet Earth today may not have been effective 100,000,000 years ago. You say, well, why is God even creating over this period of nearly 4,000,000,000 years? Well, one of the points we make in the Genesis question and in Beyond the Cosmos is that God creates primitive life at the earliest possible opportunity the laws of physics that he created and set up would afford. And he creates human life at the last possible moment. You know, one reason I can say with confidence we're headed for rapid extinction, the laws of physics aren't going to permit us to live much longer anyway. The sun's getting brighter. Maybe you've observed it. It's getting hotter and hotter every year that goes by. It's about 35% more luminous today than it was 4 billion years ago. And so as God creates, and by the way, the reason he creates so early, his goal is to create human beings with the maximum biodeposits possible. It was God's plan that we would come upon the scene with a trillion barrels of oil in the ground, with you know, a half, 500 billion tons of coal, quadrillion cubic feet of natural gas, limestone, gypsum, marble, topsoil, kerogen, tars. It was God's plan that we would have all that. And at the end of the 20th century, we are consuming 1 million years of biodeposits every year. So every year we live, a million years worth of biodeposits are being consumed by our civilization. And it's increasing. Well, I think that was all part of God's plan. He wanted human beings to come upon the scene with this vast treasure of biodeposit resources so that we could rapidly form a civilization and use that civilization to spread the good news of salvation through Jesus Christ of all the inhabitants of the planet. It's not going to happen without a little bit of technology. And that technology is fostered by all these biodeposits. In fact, we'd have a hard time surviving, period, without those biodeposits. Take the topsoil away, human beings would be impossible. We cannot live on this planet without billions of years of topsoil buildup on the surface of the crust of the planet Earth. We need that. God knew that all along. He said, I'm going to create human beings last. I also see it as in line with the grace of God. The grace of God is that we human beings would be exposed to evil and suffering for the briefest period of time. I think that applies to our entire species. You know, why have human beings sit around on this planet for millions of years when God can take care of the problem of evil and suffering in just a few thousand? So let's create human beings in those last few thousand years, and we'll take care of everything. So in that context, we would have a rationale for these transitional forms. The planet is changing because the sun is changing, and God needs to create just the right life forms at the right time deal with that increasing luminosity of the sun. Likewise, the Earth's rotation. The Earth's rotating more slowly as every year goes by. That's why our physicists keep adjusting their atomic clocks every New Year's Eve to account for the fact that the Earth isn't rotating as fast as it did the year before. And that explains why you get the small stuff first and the big stuff last. When the Earth is rotating 8 hours per day, the only things that are going to be able to survive on the planet are things that are unicellular in size. Otherwise, the 2,000-mile-per-hour wind velocities will shear anything even as big as an ant. But after a while, the Earth rotates slowly enough that ants can survive. But when it's at 24 hours a day, then human beings can survive. If it gets to be 25 hours a day, we'll either be frozen or cooked. We don't want it rotating too slowly, but it can't be rotating too rapidly either. Otherwise, the tornadoes and hurricanes will wipe us out. So that's very quick. I left out a lot of the details, but that kind of gives you a very quick sketch of why God creates in a manner that the fossil record bears testimony to. But the main point I was giving is a natural explanation simply has not sufficed to explain the fossil record. Why? Because they're getting evolution in all the wrong places. Yes.
You're speaking about how large mammals go to extinct in about a half million years. But we have examples, and sharks would not be mammals, but they're a large animal, and it seems that they have been here relatively unchanged for, I've heard, 350 million years. Just a question, why have they been so successful without change for that period of time, whereas other mammals, you know, like the horse, has so many more different species?
There have been many different species of sharks over the last couple hundred million years, and I think a more accurate way to state your question, we see sharks in the fossil record on planet Earth longer than we do see whales. Whales, 52 million years ago, that's the first whale we find in the fossil record, whereas the sharks go back a couple hundred million years. And there's a reason why sharks were survivable at that time, whereas whales were not. Sharks typically have a much less specialized food supply. So compared to whales, whales have a highly specialized food supply. Sharks typically do not. They'll eat anything they can get any calories out of. Today we have sharks that are highly selective. We have sharks that will basically only eat fat. And so they have these gigantic livers. In fact, there are some sharks where the liver is one-third the body weight. Why? Because it specializes on the fat. But if you go back a couple hundred million years, we're looking at sharks that weren't so specialized. We've got sharks today, like dogfish, that are not very specialized at all. They're basically scavengers. The fact that they're living underwater and the fact that they're deep underwater, a whale's got to come up and breathe. Sharks don't have to do that. They can stay underwater all the time. They're less exposed to radiation. Therefore, they're not getting the mutational input that the whales would be getting. And, they're not mammals. So these are all factors that would help the whales to survive a bit longer. But if you look at whales, or pardon me, sharks, we do see that sharks go extinct fairly rapidly. So there is a replacement of sharks just like there is for whales, but for whales there are many, many more. I mean, we've got an order of magnitude more replacements, almost two orders of magnitude more replacements for the sharks than we do the whales. Another good example is a crocodile. There have been crocodiles on the face of the earth for the last couple hundred million years as well. And also, there's the problem of the completeness of the fossil record. Most paleontologists would argue the fossil record is only 2% complete, and it's a little bit easier to find recent horse fossils or recent whale fossils than it is to find ancient shark fossils that are living in the oceans where the kinds of disasters that bring about fossilization don't occur. So that may be a factor as well. Over here.
Can you comment on why you believe that the universe is as old as it appears and not simply created to look old several thousand years ago?
Okay, why do I take the position that the universe is, say, 14, 15 billion years old and then not thousands of years old, as some Christians claim, who would interpret Genesis 1 as six consecutive 24 hours for the six creation days? Well, first of all, I would argue on exegetical lines alone, we're forced to interpret the creation days of Genesis as six consecutive long periods of time. This particular book I wrote in 1994 called Creation and Time, and it was really an attempt to try to resolve this issue of when did God create the earth, the universe, and the first life forms. And most of the arguments I give in the book are exegetical ones, saying if we look at the Bible literally and consistently, we see that the 24-hour view or the 12-hour view simply fails the test. And the main point I make in the book is that in English, we have two literal definitions for the word day, approximately 12 hours and 24 hours. But in biblical Hebrew, you have three literal definitions, approximately 12 hours, 24 hours, and a long period of time. And that biblical Hebrew has a vocabulary size, if you discount the proper nouns, of only 3,100 words, whereas English, over 4 million words. And so in English, we have dozens of words for a long period of time. In biblical Hebrew, you've only got one, the word yom, that's translated day. And then I jump from there to say it's not enough to take the Bible literally. We must take it consistently. And you have these three different literal options, but only one of those options permits consistency. My criticism of six consecutive 24-hour days is it forces Genesis 1 to contradict Genesis chapter 2. It forces the book of Genesis to contradict Ecclesiastes, Proverbs, Psalms, Hebrews, Romans, Revelation, etc. So if you want consistency and literalism, six consecutive 24-hour periods. Now, the appeal to appearance of age, I would argue, is unacceptable because it forces you into Gnostic theology. And this is what the Apostle Paul criticized in the book of Colossians, chapter 2. He was criticizing those emerging sects within the Christian community who were saying, well, God has revealed himself through the spiritual realm and then through the natural realm, but the natural realm is really an illusion, and therefore we don't have to pay attention to it. All we need to do is focus on the spirit part. And Paul made the astute observation that we sin in the natural realm. And if you're saying the natural realm is an illusion, what you're really saying is that sin is an illusion. And the Gnostic cults that exist today, like Unity or Christian Science, religious science, they all have that as a common belief, that sin is an illusion. And Paul's point is, God will send you to hell with that kind of an idea in your head. He came to earth to judge sin. He died on the cross for our sins. He didn't die for an illusion. He died for a reality. And that's what's so problematic with this idea of appearance of age. What you're really saying is that the natural realm is an appearance. It is an illusion. We look at the natural realm, we do not see truth. And so when astronomers look at the universe, they're being deceived into thinking those stars and galaxies are billions of years old, when in fact they're only a few thousand years old. But as an astronomer, I can tell you, there's nothing within astronomy that survives a young Earth interpretation. You have to eliminate all the forces of physics. You have to eliminate the constants of physics. You have to eliminate all the laws of physics in order to support a young Earth paradigm in the discipline of astronomy. You can't even keep stable stars if you begin to claim that this is all an illusion or an appearance of age. And that's something I've written about in a book I'm working on right now, that stars are extremely sensitive indicators of any change that God might have brought about in the past to the laws of physics. Change any of the laws or constants of physics in the slightest, stars become impossible. And there you can go to Genesis chapter 1. It tells us that stars were there before human beings were created. Stars existed throughout the six creation days and before the creation days. And therefore, the laws of physics have remained stable throughout the entire creation sequence, which I would argue is a powerful argument against appearance of age. Therefore, we really do have to listen to the astronomers. But another sophisticated form of it, which is probably even more ridiculous, is I've run into younger creations who say, look, I don't buy the appearance of age idea either. I see that as a Gnostic trap that I want to avoid. But their way out is to say that all the astronomers and physicists in the world are banded together in a global conspiracy to deceive the public about the reality of stars and galaxies. And I can tell you that my peers in astronomy and astrophysics are so cantankerous, there's no way you could support a conspiracy. They're probably the most disagreeable lot of individuals you run into on the planet. You know, all you got to do is look up the astronomical literature. These guys are fighting all the time. But that amazed me, was at Caltech. I mean, the various groups couldn't even get along with one another. In fact, they'd all sit at different tables when they would go to a restaurant. And they'd say, global conspiracy? Hey, give me a break. Over here.
Something near and dear to my heart, you. Do you feel that all the rapid latest scientific discoveries in any way support the idea that we are in the last days, or would you look to other things to support that idea?
Okay, are we in the last days? Well, I do happen to have a couple of scientific papers, and Jeannie didn't know anything about this, so don't think she was putting me up to this. There's a couple of reports here. One, that the depletion of ozone in our atmospheric layer is still a problem, even with the Montreal Protocol in effect. And so the ozone shield is not recovering. It may even be getting worse since 1997, when the protocol really began to take a significant effect. And I can give you two reasons from the scientific literature why this is the case. Number one, the people that are obeying the Montreal Protocol to really control the emissions of ozone-destroying products do not include developing nations. And the developing nations continue to pour out all these ozone-destroying chemicals at a greater rate than the developed nations that signed the protocol. So the protocol is not being obeyed by everybody. Number two, the protocol wasn't extensive enough. It basically fingered these chlorofluorocarbons, spray cans and stuff like that, as let's avoid that. And so, for example, we here in America can't get Freon anymore for refrigerators or our cars. And, you know, spray can products are under control. But in Mexico, they got a thriving trade in Freon. And I know lots of Yanks that go down there and get some black market Freon. So there are ways of getting that happening. But the problem I would point out here is that these CFCs may be simply the tip of the iceberg. Far more serious would be nitrous oxides, and nothing's being done to control the emission of nitrous oxides. Another serious factor would be high atmosphere particulates released by jet air travel. Well, I mean, people still are flying around the world in increasing numbers on jet aircraft. On the other hand, there's been some control of the Concorde. I mean, if you recall, those of you that are old, or older, I shouldn't say that, back in the 1960s, there was this big fight over whether America should get in this supersonic transport race. And if you recall, it was killed because they recognized that if we start, all of us, flying at high altitudes at 1,400 miles per hour, we're going to release so much particulate matter that it's going to wipe out the ozone layer. And so all we have today is a Concorde, and there are not very many Concordes around. But now there's some new efforts of Boeing aircraft to get into the SST market. So who knows? And by the way, we're flying enough planes at 500 and 600 miles an hour, and many more of us are flying where it's becoming more of a significant problem. So in that case, that may explain why the ozone problem is not getting better, and in fact, it's probably going to get a lot worse. And then along with that is this report that just came out, making the point that skin cancer is increasing more rapidly than any other form of cancer, particularly the deadly one, which is melanoma. Worldwide, the melanoma rate is going up 4% per year. Now, 4% may not seem much, but those of you that are into investment, if you've got an investment that's appreciating by 4% per year, it's going to double in about 15 years. And what we've seen is that probably that 4% per year may be a bit conservative, because the chance of a U.S. citizen getting melanoma in 1980 was 1 in 250. And in 1997, it's 1 in 84. And so the melanoma rate has tripled since 1980 here in the United States. And so maybe the melanoma rate, in fact, is going up faster than 4% per year, because most people tend to ignore it. And when you ignore it, you get a good chance of dying. So, and this is a worldwide phenomenon. Some people blame it on the fact that all these whites are moving to Southern California, but there's more to it than that. And there is a message in the Bible, Revelation 16, verse 2. And it said, in the last days, the days just before the return of Jesus Christ to planet Earth to finally deal with human evil, loathsome and malignant skin sores would break out on the bodies of those people in rebellion against Jesus Christ. And, you know, loathsome and malignant skin sores is a reasonably good first century description of skin cancer. So, for what it's worth. However, when people ask me, when do you think Jesus is going to come back to planet Earth? I say, hey, skin cancer may be an indication. And there are 24 other things Jesus told his disciples to look for as indicators that he would return. I think where I'm a little bit critical of all these end times prophets that are on TV and radio is there's often too much attention on one sign. And so I don't want to get you too focused on skin cancer as a sign. All it says is when you see these 25 things begin to increase in great number upon the population, then that's an indication that the time is at hand. We'd be much better off to look at all 25 than to focus just on one. But I think if you look at all 25, we see indicators right now in human history that all of them are at levels far higher than what we see in the norm of human history. And the fact that they're all happening together, I think, is a powerful indicator. But I think it'd be a big mistake to look at one sign and say, Jesus is going to return in the year 2004 based on this one sign. The truth of the matter is, and I've kind of looked at the data myself, if you look at all 25 signs, you get a very fuzzy date. The Lord's going to return and maybe the year 2020 plus or minus 40 years, okay? There are big error bars in all these, and you don't get the same date for each sign. However, for me, the sign that I think we should really pay attention to, the last thing Jesus said to his disciples is that he would come back when the Great Commission is fulfilled. What is that Great Commission? Taking the good news of salvation through Jesus Christ to all the ends of the earth, to all the ethnic people groups of the earth. And one indicator, I think, of the soon return of Jesus is the fact that the number of people that have been committed to take that message to the ends of the earth at the beginning of this century was 2% of the total human population. Today it stands at 14%. And you say, well, what's it going to take to fulfill this Great Commission? A number that was given to us in the book of Zechariah, chapter 13, is one-third. There's a statement to the effect that as far as the Jewish peoples are concerned, when one-third of them come to faith in Jesus Christ, the Great Commission for that people group will have been fulfilled. Now, nowhere else in the Bible does it give us a fraction. Although Jesus gave us one. He said it would never be a majority. But we can imply that it would be a significant minority. So something in the neighborhood of one-third, I think, is within reason for all people groups. The fact that we're at 14% today, the fact that the number of unreached people groups is shrinking rapidly, I would take as a sign that it's at hand. And I love the spin that Ralph Winter from the U.S. Center for World Missions puts on it. He says, evangelical Christians today have the money, the people, and the technology to fulfill the Great Commission in 5 years if they're really motivated to do it. But I've asked him personally, how motivated do you think evangelicals are to do it? And he says, not very. He says, actually, I'm thinking it might take 50, 100, even more years to finish the unfinished task because of the low level of motivation. And he also admits, because what he puts up in that little paper, he says, right now, Christians spend 1% of their total income on bringing other people to faith in Jesus Christ. Just 1%. The other 99% is spent on internal projects. Only 1% external. And his challenge was this. If we could just get evangelicals to move that from 1% to 10%, the Great Commission will be fulfilled in 5 years. But the problem is this. There are lots of people out there that are giving 5 to 10% towards that cause already. A small fraction of evangelicals give at that level. The rest of the population of evangelicals gives at a level that's at 0%. And so trying to challenge those that are giving 5% to give 50% is not realistic. That's not going to happen. What you got to do is challenge those that are giving nothing or giving very little to give more. And frankly, that's always been a huge challenge for the Christian community to do. But the fact that it could be done gives me cause for optimism. Go ahead.
Yes. What do you mean by divine intervention in species? Does God just say, let there be another horse? And
what do I mean by divine intervention? Well, I didn't define my term about the divine intervention that's necessary to create new species of life because in the six creation days, we notice that the text uses different creative-type verbs to describe how God brings these new species into existence. But what you basically discover is that you get a verb like dasha, let the oceans produce, let the land produce. When it's speaking about plants and when it's speaking about primitive sea animals. So but it uses verbs like asa and bara when it's speaking about birds and mammals. Asa means that God himself personally manufactures the creature. Bara means that he creates something brand new that never existed before. And in terms of the verb dasha, let the land produce, it allows three possibilities. God does it all supernaturally. God allows the land's resources to produce it naturally. Or it could be a combination of the two. The fact that it's talking about plants on the third creation day, I think explains why the text uses the verb dasha, rather than giving all the credit to natural process or all the credit to divine intervention. Plants, unlike animals, have a capacity for natural speciation. And therefore, botanists have observed under real-time observations a small handful of plant species coming into existence naturally. They've never seen it for the animal species. That's because the DNA of the plants is structured in such a way that the DNA strands can unravel and produce other strands to complement them. So there's a DNA division that's possible within the plant species. It's not possible within the animal species. So I think that's why you see the verb dasha. 99% plus supernatural, a fraction of a percentage would be natural. With birds and mammals, it's all supernatural. You're not going to get birds and mammals speciating under natural conditions. And keep in mind, we're defining speciation in this way. Because biology is such a complicated science, you do not get fixed definitions of terms like you do in physics. And so if you ask 15 biologists, what do you mean by speciation, you'll probably get 15 different answers. But I'm choosing the definition that Paul and Ann Ehrlich used in their book Extinctions. They said speciation is when you get a species disappearing from the fossil record and being replaced through natural conditions by two new species that are not capable of breeding with one another. He said that's speciation. That has never been observed by any biologist for any animal species. For plants, they've seen it, but not animals. And I'm talking even the ones like the insects where you've got a quadrillion individuals. Hasn't been seen. Yes.
You answered the question about when you think the end times are coming. I don't want to belabor that, but there's a phenomenon called polar shift that kind of goes around in some Christian circles and even astrological websites, that sort of thing. Do you know anything about that? Is there any credibility for this? And it's used to explain things like the Great Flood. The next one is apparently supposed to come in May of next
What's
year.
Supposed to come?
This next polar shift.
Supposed to come, yeah.
In May of next year. Is there any credibility for that belief? Or?
Okay, he's talking about polar shifts as something that's being discussed, particularly by Christians interested in end times prophecy. It's also been discussed by people who take the position in the Christian community that the Genesis flood was global in extent. And what it talks about is the pole. I got my model of planet Earth in there, but that's okay. You have planet Earth, and you have this rotation axis. What they're talking about is that rotation axis shifting very suddenly. And when it shifts very suddenly, the water on the planet would slosh around. And that way, thank you. Here's all my little toys here. Okay. That I stole from my son. Okay. So you have this planet. It's rotating like this. And if the rotation axis were to suddenly shift by just a couple of degrees, and yeah, you can see all the ocean water sloshing over the planet, and they say that explains the global flood. There are also those in the Christian community that say this might explain the end times catastrophes that would lead up to the return of Christ. And yes, there's this one group that says that next year we're going to get a polar shift because of the lineup of the planets. Number one, the planets line up quite frequently, and the lining up of the planets has just the slightest gravitational influence on planet Earth. I really can't imagine the lineup of the planets being able to gravitate and disturb the Earth enough to shift the rotation axis at all. Say, why are you so confident? Because it's happened thousands of times in human history and nothing like that's ever been observed. The only thing I can point out is that the moon as it orbits about the Earth changes a little bit in its orbit. I mean, it's being bounced around a little bit by the gravity of the sun and the Earth and Jupiter and so forth. And what that does is it affects the gravitational pull of the moon on the Earth. These little tiny changes in the gravitational pull of the moon on the Earth completely overwhelm any combination of the lineups of the planets. I can tell you a little joke. In astrology, there is this claim that when a child is born, the exact minute that that child is born is kind of the critical data point for astrology to predict what that child is going to turn out to be like as he or she grows up. And what these astrologers do is they calculate at the very minute that child is born the positions of all the planets. And based on those positions, they provide the mother and the father with this astrological forecast of what their child is going to turn out to be. And if you talk to these astrologers, they say, well, yeah, the gravitational influence of these planets at the point of birth is what's really critical in determining all this. The joke in all this is that the gravitational pull exerted by the obstetrician at the time of birth is 6 times stronger than the combined gravitational pulls of all the planets in any kind of possible lineup they might exhibit. So you're much better off to pay attention to where the father is and where the obstetrician is and forget about the planets. It's not going to make any difference at all. And finally, you start messing around the rotation axis of planet Earth and these little sudden jerks, nothing survives. Yeah, the oceans will slosh, but you're going to wipe out all life as well. Changing the rotation axis of the Earth by a degree in a short period of time would be total destruction of all the crustal features of the Earth, including all the life on the Earth. The Bible does not say that ever happened. In terms of the flood, Noah survived. Noah would not survive a shift in the polar axis. And likewise, when you read these end times prophecies, people survive these disasters that are being predicted to come upon the face of the Earth. Now, this is too disastrous. So in terms of how you interpret the Bible, you always have to make sure your interpretation is reasonable in terms of what the text states is the outcome of the effect. We're studying the global flood right now in our Sunday school class. And one reason I'm personally critical of a global flood is the outcome of the global flood is far too catastrophic for what the text tells us took place during and after the flood. That's one of 21 reasons why I believe the flood is universal but not global. Wiped out all humanity, but yeah, humanity was not global. Humanity was local. Okay, go ahead. He was next. Go ahead.
One of the observations that I've made personally is that God is extremely efficient in what he does. He never does anything without a purpose.
Yes.
I infer from your writings, although I haven't ever seen you state it in so many words, but I infer from your writings that you take the position that human life form, as we understand it, is unique in the world that we know. The question is regarding the numbers of galaxies in the universe, billions of galaxies, not maybe even an understatement of that, not to say of the number of stars.
Yes.
Would you believe, or would you take the position that those stars, however many they are, the unnumbered, are required for the unique existence of the life form that we see? Or would you believe that God created some numbers of them just for his glory, for us to observe as we would create a marvelous painting or something of that sort?
Sure. Yeah, my answer to both of your questions is yes.
those 100 billion trillion stars are absolutely necessary.
Like you said in one of your writings, no, it wasn't you. That's a cop-out.
Is that a cop-out? Well, let me explain why the answer to both questions is yes. Yes, God created those 100 billion trillion stars as a marvelous painting was the word you used. The heavens declare the glory of God. In fact, I just wrote a piece to the effect that Earth and Sun are positioned so that we can see it. On the vast majority of stars that exist in our universe, the heavens are not visible to any observer that's there. Earth and the Sun are positioned in our galaxy in such a way that we have a window to the entirety of the heavens. That's exceptionally rare for any star in the universe. Very few stars would afford that kind of window where we could actually see it all. So I don't think it's trivial to say that the answer to the last question is yes. God really did create this in such a way that we could see His glory in a way that otherwise would not be possible. But I think more significant is the yes answer to your first question, that you're not going to get a planet Earth unless you first have those 100 billion trillion stars. God wants human beings. Given the laws of physics He set up, the only way you're going to get human beings is to first create 100 billion trillion stars. If you create too many, you don't get a planet Earth. If you create too few, you don't get a planet Earth. You need just the numbers of stars that we see. And I'm glad you asked your question, because it's one of the most frequently expressed objections to the Christian faith. And none other than Stephen Hawking and Carl Sagan have eloquently quoted this objection, saying the Christian God is a God that doesn't waste effort. He only performs miracles that are necessary to achieve His purpose. He conserves His miracles. And the reason why Carl Sagan and Stephen Hawking have rejected the Christian faith is they say, we see too many useless stars. But both of them have failed to acknowledge that one of the 34 design characteristics of the universe that we so far observe that's necessary to be fine-tuned in order that life could exist is that its mass density must take a particular value to permit the existence of carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen. And the mass of the universe acts as a catalyst for nuclear fusion. And if you have too few stars, then fusion operates at such a low level of efficiency in the history of the universe that the only element you'll ever get is the element hydrogen. And if all you've got is hydrogen, life chemistry is impossible. But if the universe is too massive, containing too many stars, then fusion operates at such a high level of efficiency that very quickly, on an astronomical scale at least, all the mass of the universe gets converted into elements heavier than iron. And in a universe where everything's heavier than iron, there is no hydrogen, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, or potassium. If you want the elements that are essential for life, you want a cosmos where you have 100 billion trillion observable stars. You don't want more, you don't want less. It's got to be right at that number. And so, in that sense, yeah, it's not just His glory that's being displayed. It's the fact that God was focused on getting a planet Earth and creating millions of species on that planet Earth, leading up to human beings. And the context of all this, from a spiritual perspective, is that God creates the physical universe in order to conquer evil. Keep in mind that evil was here before God created us. The angels were witnesses to creation, Job 38:7. They saw the foundations of the earth. What about the universe? I don't know. It's not mentioned. But the rebellion against God in the angelic realm took place long before the Garden of Eden. And so God created human beings. He created this universe in order to conquer evil globally, not just amongst us humans, but in the angelic realm as well. And evidence for that is what you see in Revelation 20 and 21. The very moment that God conquers evil in the future, He removes this universe from existence
and replaces it with a brand new universe. When it tells us in Genesis 1 that when God created the earth, it was good. He didn't say it was best. He said it was good. It was very good. It's the best possible creation given that we have sinned within God's created realm. It's not the best if sin is conquered. And God's intent is to replace this universe with a brand new universe, a universe far superior to ours for expressing the reward that God intends for those who accept the conquest of evil. Over here.
Back to intervention. So the theory that you're saying then is it would conclude that when the horse is extinct, that
rests when he ceases from his work of creating new species of life. And we're told that that rest will continue until evil is conquered. So right now, God does not intervene in that way. And the testimony of that is the fact that biologists do not see speciation when they do their field research. When they look back into the fossil record, they see a huge amount of evidence for speciation, an average of one new species a year appearing. And so here's a rather simple way to argue against atheistic evolutionism or Darwinism, is to simply make the point, look, before human beings, very high speciation rate. After human beings, a virtual zero. Surely God was creating before, and God's not creating now, just like the Bible states. That way you don't have to get into all these complex ATP molecules and DNA and RNA and proteins as a way to try to convince your skeptical friends. Just look at the speciation and extinction rate.
So
extinction's the same on both ends, but speciation is tremendously different.
So all those horses were created before man was created?
Yeah, there have been no new horse species show up since the appearance of human beings. And, you know, one way to attack the idea that these transitions are natural, how many horse species have gone extinct this century? Half a dozen horse species have gone extinct. How many new ones have we seen? Zero. So, I mean, when we just look at the hard numbers, you realize that biology today is not the same as biology in the past. And let me add one correction. When I said the extinction rate's the same on both ends, it's the same if you ignore human abuse. Because of human abuse, the extinction rate today is actually far higher than it was in the days before Adam and Eve. But take the human factor out, it's the same at both ends. But in terms of speciation, it's not the same at all. Okay, go ahead.
Come back to your point that you made about evangelical motivation. I've been kind of disappointed with the number of debates directly between evolutionists and creationists, and at least here in Southern California.
Yes, me too.
Okay. With all due respect, you called this a skeptics forum, and yet you're kind of preaching to the choir here. Is there a reason why you don't take your message more directly to skeptics in the context of such debates and on a more frequent basis? You know, you only hold this four times a year.
Yeah, the answer to that is, of course, we do. I mean, yeah, you can say this is on church property. I'm preaching to the choir. Although the reason we do this is to give people in this church and other churches an opportunity to bring friends who are not yet persuaded, not yet believers. And also it's a recognition that the Bible encourages Christian skepticism. You know, what attracted me to the Christian faith is it kept making the point all things must be tested, and they're to continue to be tested. And so, for example, in our Sunday school class, it's attended primarily by Christian skeptics. We get a few non-Christian skeptics, but hey, if you stop asking questions, if you stop questioning what's going on, if you stop disagreeing, that means nobody's learning anything. And so I would argue that the Bible strongly encourages Christian skepticism. So this is an opportunity for Christian skeptics as well as non-Christian skeptics. But you're right, we've probably got more Christian skeptics here than non-Christian skeptics. But you know, we do this thing six times a year at the University Club in Pasadena, where it's clearly a secular environment. We do this on secular university campuses. We did this a few weeks ago at Caltech, for example, and I've done this kind of venue probably in 8 different universities since that event at Caltech 12 weeks ago, in different countries even. In fact, I did a skeptics forum just this Friday night in Orange County in a private home. So we're doing it in different contexts. And incidentally, we're committed to change where we're proven wrong. I don't claim to have a fixed theology or a fixed interpretation of science. Certain things are fixed. You're never going to catch me telling people that future scientific discovery will prove that the world is flat. You know, I believe that there are things within science where dogmatism is justified. I have the same kind of position on theology. I believe there are certain things in theology where dogmatism is justified. But there's a lot in theology that really is open to adjustment. And so I'm committed to adjust my theology. And frankly, I gain as much from these skeptics forums as anybody in the audience because I hear new things that help me build and adjust my science and my theology. I missed one of your questions.
Well, I think the second question was why haven't you, presented this more in the form of a where you get feedback from somebody who is a skeptic. I mean, somebody who's a professional biologist or something of that nature.
Well, I'm saying we would probably do that more frequently, much more frequently than we do this. And frankly, where I learn the most is where I do this kind of thing in front of an audience where the audience is entirely science professors. And what I think is encouraging from my perspective, that's also the audience where you get the greatest receptivity. You know, people think, well, you know, that's where you're going to be crucified is when you go into a setting like that. It's really quite the opposite. And I think what makes it successful is the fact that since we're all science academics, we can get technical right away. And we can cover a whole lot more material than we can that's possible in a setting like this. But what I tell those professors is, this discussion, as interesting it is, has no value if we can't put it in a form that's beneficial for the layman. And I know I was doing this at the University of Colorado a few weeks ago, and I just said, ladies and gentlemen, the stuff we're talking about today is too important for only science professors to discuss. We really need to do something to make this more public, allow the public to participate. And one of the goals we have in Reasons to Believe is that we would do this, say, as a public debate on PBS, where we might have 30 different scholars of very different theological positions have a discussion. And one of the reasons why I want to do that is to bust the bubble of public perception that if you get 30 scholars in different disciplines coming from different theological backgrounds, you're going to see the biggest fight you've ever seen. I think I would speak for all the academics. If we get a bunch of academics together that are not involved in some ideology, and what I mean by that, not committed to jam my personal opinions down your throat, and where we're all committed to make adjustments when truth reveals that we must do that, you're not going to see all this sparks and fight and heat. You see something quite different. And frankly, I think the American public needs to be exposed to that. I don't think that's ever happened on television. It'd be really great to someday make that possible. And by the way, I don't do debates. I'll tell you why I don't do debates. I do forums. What I enjoy is a forum where, say, 4 of us will speak at a platform to an audience. And all 4 of us take very different positions. And then we invite the audience to ask us questions afterwards. Or the 4 of us might have a discussion where we ask one another questions in front of the audience. Sometimes that's fruitful too. What we try to do is set up in such a way that it's not a fight. And the problem with a debate, there's got to be a winner and there's got to be a loser. We can't all come out as winners. And, you know, the motive often in a debate is to humiliate your opponent. And I don't think that's a fruitful way to really deal with these kinds of issues. And the other thing I've noticed is if you do a public debate, guess who comes? all the committed atheists come and all the committed evangelicals come. People in the middle, they stay away. And whereas Discover, if you do a forum, you get the people that are on all sides. They all come, and they're not there looking to see blood. They're there to learn. And so that's why I turn down invitations for debates. Although I will not turn down an invitation if it's done in front of scholars. For example, I've been challenged by the young earth creationists repeatedly to do a public debate on the age of the universe and the age of the earth. I said, fine, but first we're going to do the debate in front of scholars. They always turn me down. They want to do it in front of the public. My point here is, the problem with a debate in front of the public, if you are like me and have a motive to educate the public, you're going to waste your time. Because all the other guy has to do is raise an issue. It's so complicated, it's going to take you 15 minutes to explain it to the audience. Meanwhile, he's made 34 other points. And you lose the debate. And debates force you to do emotional tactics rather than intellectual tactics. So, it's been a lot of debates, but frankly, I don't think they're really the way to go in this kind of stuff. Okay, I'm getting the T sign, which means this will be the last question.
So I wanted to clarify and understand, you said there will be no more creation until evil is conquered, is that what you said? But I have a question to ask after that, yes, okay. And so, do you feel that evil will be conquered by, I mean, do you feel that evil will be conquered completely, totally in all human beings or only in selected human beings? And once it is, then will man become extinct and a new species of man will evolve? And I also wanted to know, in Judaism, they say that that man is created for the pleasure of God.
Yes.
And it sounds to me from what you're saying about the creation of the universe and our position so that we can see all the stars that there is a lot of truth in that.
Yes.
So could you integrate all that into an answer, please?
Okay. Well, I let her break my rules, so I may not remember everything. But, we were created for God to enjoy. We were created to enjoy God. But there's many more reasons than that besides for God creating. I've tried to bring up before, we're not all there is in the creation. There are the angels. Also, we need to note, according to Revelation 21, God will create again after the conquest of evil. And so, he's creating within us and in this cosmos over billions of years, thinking ahead to his calendar. Genesis 1 is the first creation week. Revelation 21 is the beginning of the second creation week. It's possible that God's got 10,000 weeks of creation laid out on his future calendar, maybe in multiple dimensions of time. It could be quite interesting. And therefore, we need to realize that what's going on today may have a lot more to do with what God's got planned on his 91st creation week than it has to do with his first creation week. And that's why, as Paul points out, we shouldn't try to second-guess God on his motives in creating the cosmos the way he did and creating us the way he did. Who knows what he's got planned for the future? Your second question?
So after evil is conquered, then you think that is the time that God would create another species of man? And until then?
No, I don't think so. Thank you for reminding me of that. We are spirit. We're the only species of life that God has created on this planet that is body, soul, and spirit. We're told in the Bible that the spirit component that makes up our being will last for eternity. So when the universe is removed from existence, human beings survive. All human beings survive the removal of the universe from existence. That's not true of the other life forms. And people sometimes ask me, will my dog be with me in heaven? Your dog is not spiritual. The text does not say there won't be dogs in heaven, but the dog you enjoyed here on earth returns to the dust, and when the universe disappears, Fido goes with that disappearance, okay? I'm not all that happy with that theology myself. I have been rather attached to some birds and mammals that I've had stay in my home over the years. And that's one of the questions I want to ask God, but I'm content with the fact that he never takes anything away without replacing it with something far superior. So no, we're not going to be replaced. We're told in the Bible that we're the very end of God's creation activity here on earth.
For the first
week. He's not going to create until evil is conquered.
And what does that mean, evil is conquered? I mean, does that mean every single person becomes good and there is world peace?
So what it means when it says evil is conquered is that there will be a finality in terms of people's response to God's offer. John chapter 1 and John chapter 3, God sends his light out into the entire creation. That light is defined in 1 John as being a combination of God's love, his life, and his truth. And that has been revealed to all of God's creation. It's been revealed even to children not yet born from their mother's wombs. And we're told that if a human responds to that light, then they will proceed towards salvation. If they reject that light, they proceed towards condemnation. But the problem is a lot of us vacillate. Sometimes we accept the light, sometimes we reject the light. We don't have a consistent pattern. But where God is leading us is to a future where that does become consistent, where everything I do is accepting God's light, or everything I do is one of rejecting God's light. And when that final condition has been achieved, for all the spirit beings that God has created, human beings and angels included, that's the moment that Revelation 20 determines the conquest of evil. Evil will no longer have an opportunity to be malignant, to spread. It's kind of like a cancer. The doctor will tell you the cancer has been defeated when the cancer no longer has a capacity to multiply and spread. Likewise, the Bible defines evil as being conquered when it no longer has the capacity to be spread. And then at that point, those that are totally committed to accepting God's light, they proceed with him into the new creation. Human beings and angels included. Those angels and human beings that are totally committed to reject the light of God, they will receive their heaven, which is hell. And you say, why do you call it heaven? Because for those that are committed to reject God's light, that's far superior than the kingdom of heaven. They'd much rather live out eternity in hell than live it out in heaven, where they would be forced to receive the light of God. God basically gives us a choice. You can choose to submit to my authority. You can choose to reject my authority. And I've created two places. One that's the best possible place if you're a rejecter, and the other one that's the best possible place if you're an acceptor. And that's one of the things I wrote about in this book, Beyond the Cosmos, is that hell really is the best possible place for the rejecters. Take away the torment from hell, it becomes far worse. God is committed to make it as pleasant as possible. But because they're rejectors, there's a limit on how pleasant he can make it. In fact, he imposes a torment to enhance the living conditions in the lake of fire. And, you know, that's the pain of God. He realizes that if only these people had accepted my light, they could be delivered from torment and receive this incredible reward in a new creation. But not everybody wants it. Okay, I think you have one more point and then we're going to close. Or did that cover everything? That's good? Okay. Let's have a quick word of prayer and then we'll be dismissed. Father in heaven, we thank you for opportunities like this where we can come together, both within the church and outside the church, and Lord, to have an opportunity to follow through in what you say. Everything must be tested. Hold fast to that which proves to be good and true. I pray as we leave here that we would continue to test what has been exposed to us, what has been revealed to us. And give us the means by your Spirit to have the will to receive that which is good and true. And Lord, may that encourage us to discover more truth than we've had before. In Jesus' name, amen.